This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Professor Gisela Kaplan is the author of Bird Minds, Cognition and Behaviour of Australian Native Birds. Hello, Gisela.
Good morning, Trevor.
Gisela, I've got four texts that says the best way to attract birds into your garden is to get rid of the cat.
That's putting it very bluntly, but absolutely correctly. And you don't need to get rid of cats. All you need to have is cat runs and keep them indoors. Bells don't work. There was a wonderful study done in England, and because there are lots of bird lovers in England and cat lovers in England too, they agreed that it should be done in conjunction with the Cat Association, and they had to admit that even the best fed domestic cat will kill at least 2.5 birds per month.
Wow.
And since they are, there was another video clip taken in Australia where people said, our cat doesn't do that. It sleeps at night and we have it under control during the day. And they put some surveillance camera on that cat that appeared beautifully asleep and quite this charming pussycat. And the moment the householders were asleep, it dug, it ventured outside and then came in just as before.
Sneaky
they
cat.
All woke up and looked again as harmless, as beautiful as ever.
Gisela, is the best way to attract birds to your garden is to create an environment that it feels comfortable and happy in, not necessarily food?
That's absolutely right. I mean, it can be for any number of purposes. It can be simply for roosting and resting in a relatively safe environment, and it can be just to get a quick go at some water for drinking, or it can be for nesting or for food. So any one of those is already a very good start, and that's quite easily achieved.
So things like bird baths work well.
Bird baths work very well, but they need to be, again, at a height, unfortunately, and in a way of clearance that the birds can approach without being seen and then enter onto it without a cat waiting at the bottom to jump there.
Okay, because that's the thing, I guess. If you all of a sudden decide to attract birds to your garden, then all the cats in the neighbourhood will be going, you beauty.
Yes. So it's absolutely right, Trevor. You can create a supermarket for predatory birds and cats and even rats and snakes. So you have to be careful that you don't have, let's say, a row of grevilleas there and all the honey eaters come and then other birds say, well, this is wonderful. We have never had such a good feast of birds before.
It's like a smorgasbord.
Like a smorgasbord. And you see, we tend to rip out those that are less attractive for gardens are those with big thorns on them, and they are the main nesting birds for small songbirds and for honey eaters, and they are so good because of the long thorns. Ravens don't want to get into it, cats don't want to get into it, and that gives them a safe haven. And those are the ones, the hekias, that we don't plant much of anymore. We plant the fluffy, cultivated grevilleas, you know, that are beautiful and easy to access for everybody.
Mm.
So in the way it used to be, I mean, when it's naturally grown, you find quite a few thorny and hairy plants that protect small songbirds from that kind of encroachment.
Well, because actually Nana Trucker sent a text saying, I planted a lot of native bushes like grevillea to bring the birds in, but being in Perth Hills, it just brings snakes. snakes come in after the birds.
Yes, well, everything comes in after the birds and after frogs as well. But, you know, to create a healthy environment, they keep each other in check, and there will then also be birds and larger birds that will go for the snakes. So you can't really do much about our pythons. They're everywhere in suburbs already, and because they can eat rats as well, so they're quite useful to have. We always have python in the roof, because that saves us from pest controls. We never have any rats or rodents. So, you know, that's quite an easy and livable arrangement, but they would like birds as well. So you've hit the head, the nail on the head, Trevor, that birds themselves have already naturally a whole lot of predators. And the only thing that can be said, they have survived for many millions of years in their kind of various niches, and have sorted out how they can solve that. For instance, I'll give you an example. Mm. When small songbirds nest, they produce eggs. All birds produce eggs, and they are the most desirable food for a vast variety of animals, including humans. I mean, we grow chicken in order to lay eggs in order to eat them. So it's a nutritious bundle. So everybody's after eggs. And the large birds go for the eggs of the small birds, but they only take them at a time when they want to raise their own offspring, because they need high protein food for that time. So that's a good thing. So the little songbirds lose their clutch usually in the first round. But then nature sets in Australia in a very clever way, because those little birds can re-nest, and they can re-nest up to three or four times in a season.
Giselle, I've got a text here that says, we're on the sunny coast and we started putting wild bird food out on a platform on our fence last year. We daily get about 60 rainbow lorikeets, 40 galahs, 35 corellas, 6 king parrots, a few pigeons, a magpie, and one single kookaburra. It's not a bad selection.
Well, no. It also shows in many cases they can sort of coexist and are relatively tolerant of each other. And that the telegraph is working very well to say, hey, there's some free food. And by the way, to people who have farms and who feel that their fruit and you know, their produce is nuts are under attack, very often it's a very simple idea to plant a fruiting tree away from the crop, or have a feeding table away from that, because they'd much rather be unmolested and enjoy a free feed than be at risk and be harassed in the orchard. So quite often you can save all your fruit by just putting a feeding table a little way away from that. So that works as well.
We'll come back to feeding birds in just a minute. We'll take some calls. Aidan, good morning.
I've had some experience with magpies when I was younger, and as I've gotten older, I've gotten to learn they're actually very smart and intelligent birds. And a friend of mine, he actually feeds the magpies and wassums and all this wildlife by hand. But I've got two mating pairs of magpies at the front of my units, but whenever you get within 10 feet of them, they will have nothing to do with you.
So, Gisella, how do you? I mean, is it a good idea to attract them and to get them to feed from you? Firstly, because we'll cover that. But if he wants to befriend the maggies, what's the best way to do it?
Well, let me put it this way: it's the magpies choose their territories, and they assess the risk for their territory. And the risk includes the humans. How nice are they? How trustworthy are they? Are they going to pose a risk for their offspring? And then they assess the animals as well. They may very well tolerate dogs if the dogs don't chase birds all the time. And if that also has a source of water somewhere, they may come and a good roosting and nesting tree. They may well come and roost and nest within the property of one person. And then it's very easy to befriend them, because if the people are nice, they won't swoop them either, then they will even introduce their offspring to them, and the occasional feed. And so, you know, real friendships can develop. And then you don't need to feed them to attract them, but you do that as you invite friends. You know, you don't feed your friends from morning to night. You may just have them over for a cup of tea or or for a dinner. And it's the same relationship there. But if you are in territory where the magpies think you may be a risk because they haven't seen you before, then it may be a very good piece of bribery and appeasement and peacekeeping to have a bit of mincemeat in your hand and say, look, oh, do you want to attack me or do you want to take that mincemeat? And usually on the first occasion they will take neither, but on the second occasion they will take the mincemeat.
So it takes a bit of time. You've got to develop a rapport and a relationship.
Yeah, and that rapport simply means that you don't run after them in a screaming way. Or as I had colleagues who, when a magpie swooped, they used an umbrella and started fencing them. Well, in terms of the risk assessment, you know, this has just gone up sky high. It's sort of like a Trump North Korea situation. You don't want to escalate the conflict. You want to tell them, look, I'm quite harmless. And they, after a while, the magpies believe you. And then and if you feed them on top of that and said, well, they're not bad people after all, you see. So, and then friendships develop, really friendships as you would expect to have with dogs that can be lifelong. And since they live for 25, 30 years, that can be for the rest of your life as well.
And good luck, because you'll develop a friend for life. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, Dave. It's a shocking line. What's the question?
I use three bird baths out the back and love watching the birds come in. And I've got one out the front and all little wagtails come in. And they got such a beautiful little whistle early in the morning. It's quite a sight to see.
Gisella, with bird baths, are they literally bathing in them? Do they drink in them? Or what are they doing?
Both.
Yep.
Literally both. It depends on the time of year and it depends on the rainfall in general. But we've got a concrete bird bath, a very big thing, where they can approach from one tree, and the yellow-tailed black cockatoos come as much as do the scarlet honeyeaters, and the scarlet honeyeaters are 10 centimetres long. And if the bird bath is very deep, it's a very good idea to put a brick or something in the middle, because some birds, if they get their feathers too wet, they can actually drown in a bird bath.
So make sure it's got something to stand on.
Yes, so if they have something to stand on, they can clear their feathers of waterlogging. It's happened to poor kookaburras that they dropped into the swimming pool because there was something on the swimming pool, like a nice juicy wasp or something, and couldn't get out again because their feathers got waterlogged, and they get so exhausted and then eventually they would die unless they're discovered just in time.
That's sad. Emily, good morning.
I'm getting all sorts of birds in my trees here, and I feed them every morning, and I even have, and the maggies bring their young ones along, and morning, afternoon, and evening before they fly off to go to bed. And first thing in the morning, Trevor, they come right up into the yard, right up to the chook pens, and they have a drink, and they love anything I put out for them.
And the dogs don't chase them?
No, nothing worries them. I don't have any trouble like that, like some people are talking about having trouble with their animals. I'm not.
Yeah, well, they're lovely. Thank you, Emily. Because I would presume, Gisella, that the magpies or a lot of the birds will also be accustomed to the animals after a while and they'll learn to trust them.
Well, I don't think they ever totally trust them. They keep a watchful eye on them.
Okay.
But they do watch their behaviour very closely. But there are unusual friendships that form between dogs and magpies. And they even, for people who are interested, they can look up YouTube, in which it is shown that dog species, various dog breeds, play with magpies.
Because I can remember once upon a time speaking to a bird expert who said that you shouldn't feed birds because it means that they then become dependent on your feeding them. So is it a little bit of a mix of both?
Of course, it's always discouraged for two reasons. One thing, people can feed the wrong thing to birds, which can kill them if they have lots of it. And if their only food source is that given by the people, then that is a disaster, because they calculate their own clutch and their breeding to the food that's available. And if they've calculated we have plenty of food and we have these rations available daily, and then the people go on holidays, then they could be in deep trouble for their offspring, and they may not be able to feed them and they starve if they're away for 4 weeks, let's say. And but most people, I don't think, do that. They feed them a little bit in the morning and say hello in the morning, you see, and then that's the rest of the day they find their own food. And that's a good compromise in most cases, unless, of course, it's poisonous.
Can you attract some birds and not others? In that, I can remember one of the spots where we're living, we used to get lots of, I can't remember what they were. They were very pretty. They were parrots of some sort. And they actually would sit on your head and feed off the top of your head. They were hilarious. Yeah. But you didn't want the sulfur-crested gillards, because they would eat all the wood that was on the balconies. So can you attract some and not others? Can you be selective?
Well, you can, but, when the sulfur-crested cockatoos do that, they actually usually feed on the ground or feed in the treetops on various nuts. But when they go into the city, they have... they're either bored and they need to exercise their beak the whole time, because it keeps growing. The upper mandible keeps growing, and it would be too long and they couldn't then pick up food anymore. So they have to sharpen the upper mandible, and it's a bit unfortunate if they get into wood that happens to be a windowsill.
They do a very good job on it too. Michael, good morning.
Yeah, hi, Trev.
Yes, Michael.
I've got a family of Maggies.
Mm-hmm.
Had mum and dad had been here for about 4 years. Finally, last year, they brought their first two chicks around. This year, they've got four chicks. And they almost regard this as their territory.
Yeah.
And anything that comes near them, because I don't feed them in the morning, mum comes up and sits beside me in the morning, within 18 inches of me. But afternoon, after about 5 o'clock, I feed them, I give them mints. Well, that's their territory. And they attack ravens, they attack plovers, they attack butcher birds, they attack brush turkeys to get them off the territory.
Actually, that's a really good point, because if there are some, like, miners, Indian miners and that sort of stuff, Gisella, will it keep those sorts of horrible birds away?
Well, Indian miners are a real danger to all hole nesting birds, because it has been found that Indian miners, which is an introduced bird, by the way, are very clever, and they will even kill crimson rosellas and get them out of the nest hole to nest there themselves. So they're a bit of a plague, because they really do harm to native birds. But the other reason is, of course, ravens steal eggs, and they will also steal magpie eggs and ruin their nests. So they're not very keen to have them around. And their ravens only do it because they want to feed their own young for that period of time. So there is a little bit of intolerance there. At other times of year, it's no problem.
Actually, because you were talking about eggs earlier. Is that one of the things, if you put an area for nesting, do you also then have to make sure that the eggs are protected or looked after, or the birds just do that?
The birds do that, and they do that very efficiently, and particularly magpies are fantastically vigilant, and they've protected many birds by knowing exactly. I mean, butcher birds take live nestlings and do something really dreadful, like putting them on a stick and then feeding on them. So that's not very pleasant, and any bird that can get rid of them at nesting time has done a good job. But that kind of fighting and tension doesn't go on outside the breeding seasons, and they are quite comfortable with each other all the time.
Frank, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor.
Yes, Frank.
Oh, well, I got magpies that land on my balcony, and they just came here, second floor, and they... feed, and they walk in the place in the kitchen, and one has followed me around the table many times, and I don't mean to do this, but he walks in, or she, and goes to the cat's biscuits and picks them up and eats them. Now, my big red cat, he sort of tolerates them. He's got older. He's 16. And I think he'd like to kill them, but he doesn't. He just sort of he knows I feed them. And they brought their young up, and it nestles in a pot plant. But I do notice, they're beautiful creatures. They cooey me if I'm up at 5 in the morning. One will be on the rail and let out a cooey like I'm here, and the young one's getting used to this too. It's starting to feed itself. The good thing about it, you can observe nature. But I'll tell you something, what I do notice, I'm on a road, not the busiest of roads, and I think they're nested in a Norfolk pine, but they do get killed on the roads now and again by cars. Especially if people feed them on the footpath, the mother will or father will fly over the road, but the young ones seem to walk across, and I think they get hit by cars. Someone told me other birds might get them, the young ones, but you do see them dead on the roads. So.
What's more likely, Gisella?
Well, actually, this is a very important point there that was just made, and that is, they're highly intelligent. They're capable of a number of really incredible behaviours, and they probably have as many neurons in their small brains as chimpanzees or some of the primates. But when it comes to territory, they are not open to reason. And that means this is our territory. Anybody who comes into our territory, which may include a road, should politely slow down and let me pass. And then they could go on. And that's the only explanation I have for the number, excessively high number of road kills of magpies. We did a survey for quite a number of years and found that magpies were on the top of the list of birds killed on the road. And that is the explanation. And I've seen cases where I drove up to the magpie and it was standing its ground. Now, I think that's a bit silly, to stand your ground against the car.
Yes. However, mind you, if I had a choice, if I was walking along, I'd be the one that was moving. I've got a text here that says, Stephen Kalgoorlie says, WA has had a policy to report and destroy starlings. What's the significance of the starling to warrant the destruction of them?
Well, there's a long and very controversial debate about any introduced birds, and we also have blackbirds, and we have these turtle doves, which have now been here since the 1840s, and we are a country that's not only open to migrants but actively encourages them, and the immigration and introduction of non-native species to Australia as a transfer is the largest that has ever happened in the world history. From carps to insects to foxes to settler population has done a job that biology has never achieved in a single year. So we now get excited about a single species that comes on of its own accord or stows away and then blossoms here. I would make the distinction always, how much does it harm any local species and how much doesn't. The blackbird, for instance, for the life of me, I can't see how it does any harm to native species, and they coexist very peacefully, but not the the Indian miner. That's quite aggressive and quite dominant.
Cara in New South Wales and Hunter Valley says, I enjoy the superb wrens, the blue wrens in my backyard. It's very overgrown, which allows them to nest each year, safe from predators. The babies with their quarter-inch straight tails delight me with their antics. And they also love the cheese I offer them.
Well, and there's another wonderful thing. I neglected my garden one year and had all the cabbages full of aphids, and some superb blue wrens discovered them on a flyby and stayed forevermore and ate all the aphids, and I never needed to spray the cabbages, and my negligence was rewarded.
See, we forget that quite often because you were talking before about the snakes and the birds and the spiders and the ants and the insects and all the rest of it, that really it's just an ecosystem in your backyard and they know how to balance things out within it.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. And not only that, they are very useful to us. I mean, we would drown in insect pests evermore if we didn't have all the birds. We would have no forests if we didn't have the birds. And so they fulfill very important functions. In fact, we wouldn't have any fruiting trees at all. Do you know who the hero of the fruiting trees is?
Hummingbirds.
No, the absolute
bees.
Hero is, well, the bee is very important, the bats are very important, but the currawong, and that the currawong has been so misunderstood because it's one of the major, major dispersal agents for native fruit in Australia, and if they go, so go all the native fruit trees.
Rosemary, good morning.
I would like to know, do ravens form strong bonds with each other? Because I had, the other morning at about 4:45, there were several of them started up a performance and they appeared to be pecking at something. And this went on for 3 or 4 hours, and when I took a close look, there was a dead raven caught in the bush. And they continued for a while, then they went away and came back late afternoon. Meanwhile, my neighbour removed the dead bird. But this performance went on for 3 or 4 days. Do they sort of, it was like they were mourning or grieving. Do they do that?
Gisella?
What an excellent question. First of all, something very important to be said. Most Australian bird species pair for long periods of time, and many for life, and the raven is one of them. And they form these lifelong bonds that are pretty unbreakable. And I've had personal experiences with even tawny frogmouths that are also bond for life, for a grieving period in which one partner actually died, wouldn't leave the partner alone, it was dead on the ground, and very mournful cries. And it's thought that ravens may well fall into that as well. And that, of course, is an ability that we never thought they had. But it means that they're capable of deep emotions and deep affection and loyalty. And ravens only raise one young a year, but they live for a long time and they stay together for a very long time. So, yes, that is quite possible. And that's a very interesting observation. I don't think anybody has ever made that.
Well done, Rosemary.
Oh, thank you.
Good on you. Hey, we've had this question asked a few times, Gisella, and I don't know if it's a silly question or not, but I'm sure you'll tell me if it is. We do a question and answer thing on Mondays. Someone has asked, why is it that we see very few dead birds, apart from ones that have been hit by cars and that sort of stuff? Do they sort of go somewhere to die, or is it that they just die in the bush and they decompose quickly?
Well, all of that is true. I mean, either they get eaten or decompose, but usually birds try not to show that they are dying. So they would hide somewhere, and as long as they think they have a chance of recovery, they will sit very still to the inside of a tree and hope nobody catches them out, because that is usually bad news for one's lifespan. So, and of course, they decompose very quickly. That's one of the problems, but to establish when what happened in the history of birds, because I leave so few fossil records.
Oh, so they hide. So I guess because they're very vulnerable if they're sick or if they've broken a leg or a wing, so they hide so that they can't be attacked.
Yes, and the worst that can happen is they go to the ground and can't get back up again, and then, of course, there will be a predator about that will put them out of their misery.
Charles, good morning.
Morning, Trevor.
Yes, Charles.
I'm just starting to say that when we first came off a farm. We bought 25 acres near Warrnambool nearly 25 years ago, and we had only had cypress trees around the house, nothing else. And we set out to the plantations, and one of the disappointing things at that time was there was very little guidelines as to species to plant for birds, which has since changed. There is now books and things available. But so we set out and we did our research and planted trees, and of course a whole lot of species came back. And one of the most spectacular that we never saw before, and we now see now every year, is the quite large flocks of the yellow-tailed black cockatoos.
And how long are, so, and are they coming back regularly now?
Yeah, every year now, but we never saw them prior to planting the trees. We probably just, we didn't have the seeds for them.
Yep.
That they eat.
But Gisella, I'll just go back to Gisella. How good is that? And firstly, being able to make sure that you provide the right vegetation to bring back certain birds.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You can redo a lot of repair. Don't forget, we've got now all sorts of new laws that actually allow more freedom in clearing, and there's more clearing happening now in Queensland and more New South Wales thanks to the new legislation. And that's a disaster. And if people think of birds and their habitat and how important it is to keep those birds for all sorts of good reasons, then it's important to leave the old trees there. And the old trees have holes in them, and the nesting holes are of huge importance to so many species, not just the birds, you know, possums and gliders, and all of them need some sort of nest hole. And you can't reproduce them. Most of them get only reproduced in trees over a 100-year period, so it takes a bit too long for birds if they want to nest. But for feeding them, you can do that very quickly, actually. For instance, the casuarinas and the she-oaks, absolutely wonderful large parrot fruit, and especially the glossy ones, they grow very quickly, and unfortunately, most people have ripped them out because they're not all that attractive, but they are an enormously attractive tree and shrub for parrots. So good on you for having brought them back.
Don't you think we would have learnt by now that when you destroy trees and bush and forests, that you destroy habitat and we lose even more species of animals, and we destroy yet another one, and perhaps we make yet another species extinct. We're not a very smart lot, Gisella, really, are we?
Well, you see, Australia is one of the most highly urbanised Western nations. So most people in the city don't think of trees. They don't think of birds. I've gone to a primary school and played back bird song, and the only one they recognised was the kookaburra. They didn't know any other species. So, you know, just like the banana is grown in the supermarket, so perhaps that connection, unless we start teaching much more actively and more proudly, I think, of the extraordinary wildlife we have. You see, the birds are very smart and they have adapted to a very fickle climate. But what's happening now, you get all the clearance happening, and there are lots of wonderful people who actually plant things. And at the same time, you get these climate changes that force birds to move, let's say, from hotter climates to cooler climates. So you get sudden refugees from everywhere that you would normally get only from droughts, but suddenly you get more of those. And when you get more hot fires, you also get more destruction. So you get a clash of human-made disasters plus climate change, and that could get well too much for birds. And yes, we could look at more extinction unless we really convince politicians that they have to think of Australia as a bit more as a political place, but as a natural place and as stewardship for the place. You know, that's part of the nation and something to be very proud of, I think.
True. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. Look, I used to have lots and lots of sparrows around my place, which was wonderful, but the minor birds have driven them all away and I don't see them anymore. But what I'm ringing about is that I had a galah, and I had him for a number of years, and he loved to sit out the afternoon with me, and he would have a little nip of scotch, and the snake crawled in and killed him. And then this morning I went out to feed my budgie, which I've had for quite a number of years, and I had some fine chicken wire over the cage, and that was a snake in the cage, and he had eaten him. And I'm just wondering, what can I do to keep the snakes away?
Michael, I guess because one of the things, people have relationships with all sorts of animals and pets, and when you have a long relationship, especially with parrots, and when cockatoos live for such a long time, they're quite close relationships, Gisella.
Oh, they are definitely, and galahs in particular. But galahs are sensitive, loving, learn very quickly. They also learn words very quickly, and they are able to use them in the correct context. I think I might have told you before, Trevor, but I had a wonderful galah called Philip, and he, when I went out at night, he was cross with me. I shouldn't have gone out, and when I came back, he turned his back to me, but then he said, turning his head around, "Where have you been?"
Why did you get the name? How did you get the name Philip?
Oh, he just behaved like Philip, very, very regally, and he learned all the dog names as well. And I think galah is one of the few birds with a sense of humour, because he just called the birds, had these huge Rhodesian Ridgebacks sit up in front of him, then paraded across the four of them, looked at them, and then sort of chuckled and walked away. Just left them there.
Michael wants to know, what's the best way to keep his bird, well, like snakes, away from his birds?
Well, I have this problem every single year, and the only way I've come up with protecting them is to make the make a double kind of wire thing, the good strong wire, so they don't cut their feet on the inside, and chicken wire on the outside. And even then, I've had some of the rainbow lorikeets taken, and it fills one with sadness and even fury, and all sorts of emotions go through you. But they are such a convenient food source that that's the only thing you can do, is to make sure. And if people have aviaries, they should always have metal bars that go under the ground and like an L-shaped thing right around the aviary, because rats will make holes through that, the snakes will follow, and then they're inside the aviary. So that's the best one can do.
Michael, good luck. Rainey, good morning.
I'm so sorry to hear that, actually. I can fully appreciate it, how one feels, because the galahs are exceptionally good company.
Yeah, good friends. Rainey, good morning.
How are you?
Yes, what can we do for?
I'm in Goolwa in the Fleury Peninsula, and we have a lot of tiny little honey eaters, and I've got two massive trees. Now, I'm not sure what they are, but they've got all these red flowers on them, which they absolutely love. But I also put seed bells out for the native birds in the trees. I'm just wondering what I can do to keep these beautiful little, and they're only very tiny little honey eater type birds, in the garden.
Yep, Gisella?
Well, at times when, flowers and plants like Christmas bush, and that could be a Christmas bush or various other trees, don't produce these wonderful flowers, then sometimes just a bit of sugar water in a little a dish, they will learn very quickly where to find that. And there's also a Wombaroo nectar mix that one can prepare a slurry, and that helps them over some tough months. Don't forget, there's one important thing about the Australian bush, and that's another reason you mentioned that, cutting down the trees. I discovered in one forest that all the honey eaters had gone, and I wondered why that was. And then I looked at all the flowering trees, and I realized that there were several species missing that should have been there. And had they been there, they would have been flowering 12 months of the year. And one of them, of course, in logging cycles of the 30s and 50s, they took out every cedar that was around, and they have a flowering time of 2 to 3 months. So that is a problem, that we don't have continuous food supplies anymore for specialist feeders, you know. So having feeders out in times of this non-flowering period is a good idea to keep them there.
Gisela, it's always good to talk to you.
It's always lovely to talk to you, Trevor.
And now we should point out that there's a place called habitatnetwork.com. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's one of the internet sites. I like this one in particular because it talks about what plants and how to arrange them and the names of plants and where to get them. And it's a big help because it depends on the question you have, but they seem to have just about covered every possible question. You can also join them and ask them questions, and that's probably all very helpful because, you know, it's no good having good intentions and not knowing where to start, which is reasonable. I'm not very good in plants, so any help I can get, I'm happy to accept. So that's one very good site. But there's an interesting argument that's been made in a recent paper that was about Chicago, and that could well apply to Sydney. Said the more middle class it gets and the more inner city it gets, the more hostile it gets to wildlife, because the new fashion is to have everything in concrete and steel and to look modern. Every blade of grass is removed, and you only have perhaps an, you know, cactus or algae in the garden. So that applies to here as well. And of course, then all the wildlife disappears. But if you plant natives, and this is also a call to councils, most councils still plant roses and European things. I'd love to see Australian cities become Australian.
And hopefully we will. Great to talk to you, Gisela.
Thank you, Trevor, for allowing me this little speech.
No, I love talking to you. Cool, we'll talk again soon. Professor Gisela Kaplan, author of Bird Minds, Cognition and Behaviour of Australian Native Birds. This is Overnights on ABC Radio.